All our craft and surface observers have a small mechanism which will enable them to lock into synchrosism with this wave. This automatically maintains them on the proper frequency level without any further mental effort on their part. They can drop out of sync at any time and take over mental control if they should desire to slightly change their level. In a recent incident over Washington, our craft suddenly disappeared from sight, and a flight of your aircraft flew through the spot. Your radar, which has a much higher range of perception than your eyes, continued to record the presence of our craft. They were, in fact, still there. The operators had merely raised their frequency level slightly in order to avoid a collision, and your aircraft were able to actually fly through ours. Some have termed the sudden appearance of our craft a materialization. This is not usually correct in the normal usage of the word. Our craft are quite material at all times. If you travel from New York to Washington, your reality has ceased to exist, so far as the New York range of perception is concerned. Yet you are actually the same, you, and are quite real to yourself and to anyone else on the Washington range of perception. It is exactly the same with our craft, except that, instead of traveling on the surface, they are traveling up and down the scale of vibrational frequencies. Actually, they may often be moving in the length, breadth, height dimensions while simultaneously traveling in this fifth dimension, which is completely independent of the four-dimensional time-space continuum. Einstein and some of your other advanced thinkers now realize that the various forms of energy with which you are familiar, light, heat, gravity, electricity and magnetism, are merely different forms of the same force. This primary energy flow, which permeates all space, is so high in frequency that they can only postulate it. It has no characteristic which will register on their physical senses, or on any instruments which they can devise. It is imperceptible until modified in some manner, just as electricity is imperceptible until you introduce some modification, such as resistance, inductance or capacitance. In this, as in any other solar system, the Sun is the focal point of these primary energy flows. Contrary to popular opinion, the Sun is neither hot nor luminous. Its radiations are these same characterless primary energy flows. These are converted into light's heat, cosmic rays, and other forms by certain elements in your own upper stratosphere. The Sun does radiate sufficient energy to produce the temperatures which your men of science compute, but the actual conversion into heat is not accomplished at the Sun. It only appears so due to the fact that you are seeing it off your conversion zone. When viewed from any planet which has an atmosphere, the other planets and stars would appear about as they do to you. In space, however, all would be dark and cold. The planets would glow very faintly, due to the refraction of very small part of the energy flow, but most of the flow is directed downward to the surface. The light, which you see from the planets and stars, is not transmitted as light. It is a reflected, or, in the case of the stars, energy flow which is converted into light in your own upper stratosphere in the same manner as the solar flows. It should be noted that, when I speak of space, I do so with reference to your frequency level. There are many different frequency levels, or planes, beyond your range of perception. Each of these contains many worlds. Some of these coexist with, or overlap, planets visible to you. Others are in what you regard as empty space. Your own worlds is also empty space on the perception range of some of these other worlds. My present home is not on a Venus you see, but on a higher frequency level world which is somewhat larger than the Venus, which you know. Someday your advanced thinkers will go on to the next fact, namely, that what you call solid objects are also merely another form of these primary energy flows. They are merely energy which has been slowed down, by some external influence, to a very low level. They have been created from pure energy, and are constantly straining to break free from the restraining force and return to pure energy. It is this fact which makes all objects perishable. All things must, by progressive means, return to their original source. Footnote: Edward S. Schultz, regional director of BSRA, points out that this same tendency of material to break free from the restraining force exists on all levels or planes, and is the cause of natural radioactivity. Continues. Since material objects are only another form of energy, they are subject to all the physical laws which governs energy. They can be converted from one form to another. The frequency level of their existence can be raised or lowered. Just as several different messages of different frequencies can be transmitted over the same cable without interference, so too can several different material objects of different frequency levels occupy the same space without interfering with each other in any way. They can, and do, coexist intradimensionally. Chapter 4: The Sources. There has been considerable controversy among your disc experts as to whether the objects they see are built and controlled by mental means or by orthodox but very advanced scientific principles. The former thesis has been offered by Mead Lane, founder of the Borderland Sciences Research Associates, who believes that many, if not all, of the larger spaceships are projected as mental constructs which then draw to themselves etheric or physical matter. The other hypothesis is the favorite of those who are mentally unable to accept any paraphysical explanation. Either might be right as regards any individual sighting. It would depend upon who was operating the craft, and certain other circumstances. It should be understood that anything which can be done by the use of any of the physical sciences can theoretically be done by mental means alone. The degree of the maximum potential, which any individual can attain, depends on his individual knowledge and ability. Different branches of the elder races have different interests, and have developed their maximum skill in different fields. There are some who make almost a cult of the mental sciences, and will not use any sort of mechanical device if it can possibly be avoided. The Gnors, on the other hand, will go to great lengths to accomplish the same results by use of various devices, even when the objective could be accomplished quite easily by use of the mental sciences. Our technicians claim that this permits them to concentrate their mental attention on other tasks. The visiting, or tourist, craft may often be constructed and controlled entirely by mental means. The Gnor craft usually made and driven by means of the various physical sciences. The control of our craft is usually either manual or automatic, although the operator can take over mental control at any time, and frequently does under certain conditions. The method of construction does not make any important difference in the nature of the object. You would be unable, by examination, to determine whether an object had been made by mental or physical means. The members of the patrol, who operate our craft, are much more skilled in the mental sciences than the rest of our people. Physical means are neither as versatile nor as quickly responsive as mental means. On the present assignment, conditions are well known and operations can be largely routine and automatic. On other assignments, they may be working with many unknown factors and must be on the alert to meet any sudden development. Under such circumstances, they customarily drive and control the craft entirely by mental means. The tourist craft, which you might see from time to time, are so varied that it would be impossible, even to catalogue them all. You might literally see anything. They might be the same ships in which these visitors had come from some distant world, although it is not likely. It is much more probable that you would see merely the small craft which most of these larger craft carry, much as your ocean ships carry small boats. It is not impossible, however, for these interplanetary ships to land directly on your planet. The main reason that they do not do so, is that they are usually huge, by your standards, and would be likely to attract too much unwelcome attention. The craft operated by my people are the most numerous over your planet at the present time, although they are not necessarily those which are most frequently seen. They often operate just above your visual limit, in order to escape observation by your people. They would, in such cases, perhaps be visible to a few people who had an extended visual range. They would also register on your radar. Those of our craft most likely to be seen by you are essentially aircraft, not spacecraft. They could operate in space, to a limited degree, in case of emergency, but are usually brought to your planet by large carriers. We are currently using 7 different types of these small flyers over your planet. 5 of them carry crews, while 2 are robot devices, which are remote controlled from some other point. Their descriptions are as follows. 1. And 2. These are essentially the same type, except for size. They are crescent-shaped, resembling a disc from which a bite has been taken. The first is about 45 feet wide by about 18 feet high. The other is only about one-third this size and is normally operated by one person, although it can carry one or more passengers if required. Both are reconnaissance craft. They are very ancient types, almost museum pieces as compared to some of our other types. They are particularly well suited to the requirements of the present mission, however, and so are the most used of all the types. They are driven by 2 jets set in a universal mounting at each joint of the crescent, and controlled by changing the direction of the jets, thus eliminating all external surfaces. 3. A cigar-shaped craft, about 100 feet long by 25 feet at its maximum diameter. This type might be likened to your Navy destroyers in its functions. It is used to protect the smaller flyers when necessary, and for rescue operations. It is also used for escort duty, and you are quite likely to see such a craft escorting visiting or tourist craft. It is frequently not considered advisable, for various reasons, to permit such visitors full freedom of unsupervised travel over your planet. These craft use both jet and primary drive. 4. A donut-shaped craft, about 125 feet outside diameter by about 36 feet thick, with a hole about 25 feet in diameter in the center. They are used only when complicated scientific observation of some nature is required. Due to the large amount of test equipment which they carry, they have become known as flying laboratories. They use electromagnetic drive, and are not likely to be seen by your people except on comparatively rare occasions. 5. A spherical, or ball-shaped, craft about 100 feet in diameter. It uses electromagnetic drive, and is a passenger and cargo transport ship. It might be compared to a marine lighter, which carries cargo from the shore to a ship standing out to sea. It is seldom used in the present operation, as there is very little to be transported between our ships and your planet. It is possible that you might occasionally see one of this type, however. 6 and 7. These two are also essentially the same type except for size. Both are ball-shaped, one being about 5 or 6 feet in diameter, while the other is only about a foot in diameter. They are remote-controlled observation craft, and usually are used where the larger manned ships would attract too much attention. They record both visual sightings and other data, and transmit it back to the parent ship. They are regarded as quite expendable, and we sometimes disintegrate them when their specific mission is finished, rather than take the time and trouble to return them for reuse. The green fireballs seen in your skies cannot properly be listed among the others. They are more comparable to your guided missiles than to aircraft of any sort, only these have a peaceable mission. They are composed chiefly of a colloidal isotope of copper, and are used to mop up the excessive radioactivity resulting from your A-bombs. While this operation is beneficial to you, its chief purpose is to prevent harmful results on other vibrational levels. The jet drive used by us consists of a small pear-shaped reactor into which a very small stream of fuel is injected. This is disintegrated within the chamber by a small electronic ray. The resulting expansion, rushing out of the exhaust port of the reactors, produces the desired thrust. Any material which can be reduced to a liquid or powder may be used as fuel. Water or air are the most frequently used fuels over an inhabited planet, since their reactions produces very short-lived radioactive end products, and thus does not cause any permanent atmospheric contamination. The electromagnetic drive obtains its power by cutting the natural lines of force of a planet. The action is much the same as that of your electrical generators. The craft are oriented on the magnetic meridians in such a manner that a small electron beam will drive them. They can cross the meridians, or travel at an angle to them, in a manner similar to that used by your sailboats when tacking into the wind. This form of drive can obviously be used only over some planetary body, but this body does not necessarily have to be on your vibrational level. Primary drive is the only true space drive, aside from teleportation. It consists of mechanism, which will place the craft into synchronous frequency with the primary energy flows which permeate all the universe, but slightly out of phase with them. The speed is theoretically unlimited with the speed of sound. In actual practice, the maximum speed when using primary drive depends largely upon the skill of the operator in controlling the craft, and upon the degree of phase angle which can be applied, and that depends on the amount of shading power which the craft can supply. In addition to these methods of driving them, all craft are equipped with mechanism, which will enable them to hover motionless when desired. A cone-shaped repulsion field is created above the ship, which diverts the flow of gravity around it much as an umbrella would divert a fall of rain around its user. These diversion fields are frequently employed while the craft are in motion for the purpose of reducing their effective mass. This reduces the amount of power needed to drive them, and also makes them more maneuverable. Both the diversion field and their electromagnetic form of drive create an ionization of the air above and around them. Under certain atmospheric conditions, this will result in a visible corona discharge. It is quite possible that, in many of the reports of fiery inverted cones and flaming balls, the observers were seeing this corona discharge rather than the body of the craft itself. In some of these cases, the actual craft may have been operating slightly above the visual range of the Adamic peoples, and only the corona discharge could be seen by them. Chapter 5. The Space Patrol. The name Space Patrol is not the one which we use, but I have selected it because it gives a fairly accurate picture of its functions. The name which we use would mean nothing to you. The patrol is under the direction of a sort of galaxy council, composed of representatives of all the advanced planets on all vibrational levels or planes in this galaxy. The council functions in very close relationship with similar groups in other parts of the universe. Again, the name which I am using is not the correct one, but will give you the most correct impression of its purposes. The patrol might be called the executive branch, and, when need be, the armed services, which carry the decisions of the council into effect. They guard backward worlds against any outside threat, although it is not contended that they are always completely effective in this function, and evil visitors may occasionally do some damage before they are detected and countered. When a new world is evolving, they aid it by giving various bits of scientific and ethical information, although such activity is somewhat limited by their own code of ethics. This subject is reserved for a later chapter. If it should become necessary, they would also guard the rest of the universe against any of these backward worlds. In addition to this, they enforce certain regulations concerning interplanetary and interplane travel. They supply visiting craft with information of interest and importance regarding the places which they wish to visit. They aid any craft which might be in trouble. They explore and chart previously unknown areas. They are constantly rechecking and verifying data regarding the various planets and planes. When a new world is to be colonized, they aid in the establishment of the various life forms, and maintain favorable technical conditions until the newcomers are able to shift for themselves. Membership in the patrol is theoretically open to any member of any of the advanced races who are able to meet the very strict requirements. In actual practice, however, It has become almost exclusively the hereditary calling of certain of the Gnors. Many of the other advanced races have no desire for this type of service. Members of the patrol, on the contrary, have an intense attachment for their service. When they die, they usually reincarnate as the children of patrol member parents. These children are given preference for patrol service, and are trained almost from birth. As a result, there are seldom any vacancies for outside applicants. The patrol uses several different types of carrier and other interplanetary craft, according to the requirements of the particular mission. The only carrier used over your planet so far on the present mission is a multi-purpose craft which might be compared to your naval heavy cruisers. It is cigar-shaped, about 7,000 feet long, and will normally have on board about 2,000 persons, including the crews of the small special-purpose flyers. Their main purpose in the present instance is to serve as bases and coordinating centers for these small craft. They normally operate high above the range of your radar, but have occasionally been seen by your astronomers. The part, which probably would be of greatest interest to your scientists, would be the control room. Here they would see a large room with a row of console-type desks set in the form of a horseshoe. At the center would be the raised master control desk of the officer on watch at that time. At these desks, crew members would be seated in front of an imposing array of screens, meters, dials, and control knobs. I say that your scientists would be interested in this, but I fear that not even the most advanced of them would be able to fathom the purpose of them, since they are based upon a science many thousands of years in advance of your own. The crews are composed of both men and women. In certain duties it has been found that one sex will excel. In others the positions are open to either sex without discrimination. Many complete family units are carried, since these craft are the only permanent homes, which many of the members know. On the present mission they are operating from nearby bases, and crews can be frequently rotated back to their home bases. In other instances the craft might be operating far from any permanent base, and might remain on station for many years. Thus, if the crew members are to have a normal family life, they must take their families with them. This does not result in excessive and active personnel, since both husband and wife are assigned to the same ship. The crew's quarters are divided into three sections: 1. The family area, for married couples and their minor children; 2. The women's section for unmarried women; 3. The bachelor quarters for single men. The latter two areas are forbidden territory to any member of the opposite sex, including even their highest officers. There is still ample opportunity for romance, however, and marriages among the younger crew members are common on board ship. There have been instances, on very long missions, where children have been born, grew up, married, and began to raise families of their own, without ever having been off their ship. These carriers are heavily armed, chiefly with various forms of blast and disintegrator rays. These would compare to your H-bomb about as the H-bomb would compare to a bow and arrow. They are seldom used, but a full complement of rays, as the operators of this mech are called, is always available. They are normally employed at alternate duties, but can be summoned to their battle stations on a moment's notice. It is rarely necessary to actually use them. The mere knowledge that such an overwhelming amount of force is available is usually sufficient to calm down any who might otherwise be inclined to be belligerent. This heavy armament should not cause any alarm among your people, as there is neither any intent nor any foreseeable possibility of using it against you. The code of the patrol, which is religiously observed, forbids the use of force if the objective can be attained by any other means. In the present instance, any decision which they might be called upon to enforce could be put into effect by non-violent and very unobtrusive means. Events would work out in a quite logical and natural appearing sequence. It is not likely that even those directly concerned would suspect anything beyond a peculiar coincidence. It might be interesting to note that, contrary to your customs in the matter of armed forces, These fighting rays are invariably female. When the commander gives an order to attack, it is only after all other means have failed. By then the situation has usually become very precarious, and instant response on the part of the rays is essential. Experience has shown that women will respond more quickly, and will kill with fewer mental compunctions, than men. This is due to a basic psychological difference between the sexes, a derivation and extension of the protective mother instinct. The female of the species is more deadly than the male, even among the more advanced peoples. The patrol is highly organized, and has a complicated chain of command. There is no lack of discipline but, in common with all of our social and governmental organizations, the officers have no real coercive authority. They retain their posts only so long as they retain the confidence of those under them. If their subordinates should, by common consent, adopt a decision of no confidence, and transmit it to the next higher in command, the officer concerned would be automatically removed. After examination, and further training, if necessary, he might be reassigned to some other post. Such incidents are very rare, however. The selection and training is so carefully done that there is usually no question as to the competency of any officer or crew member. These larger interplanetary craft use a variety of drives. From their advanced base on Luna to their customary station above your stratosphere, is a very short trip in their concept of distances, and they would probably use ordinary jet drive. The same form of drive could be used for a journey to Mars or Venus, but it would be more usual to employ Primars drive for such a trip. For still longer distances they would teleport. In this mode of travel, the ship and everything in it is momentarily converted into pure energy, almost instantly transferred to another location in space, and reconverted into material form. This operation is obviously very delicate and, while it can be done by the use of mechanism, the more experienced commanders usually prefer to do it by entirely mental means. This same principle is employed in several other varieties of mechanisms. If the reconversion step is left out, and the energy merely shorted out to ground, it becomes a disintegrator ray. A pattern of any desired object can be made from any easily worked material, and the energy of other materials packed into it to create artifacts of materials, which could not be worked by ordinary means. Alloys of dissimilar elements, which could not be combined by ordinary means, may be made. The packing-in process may be continued until the desired density is secured. It is possible to bring a piece of very hard material almost to the conversion point, shape it like putty, and then remove the ray and let it become hard material again. Chapter 6 Mores and Morals. In my introduction I said that I liked to think that my people averaged slightly higher on the ethical scale than the Earthians. Some of you may feel inclined to contest this statement, because our code of ethics is different in many respects from yours. We see many things from an entirely different point of view. There are wide variations among our people, as among yours, and it is quite likely that the higher ones among you are higher than the lower ones among us. Those who man our patrol ships, or who have been sent among you as surface observers are, needless to say, carefully selected as to moral and ethical standards. As stated before, we intently study the manifestations of the unnameable in an effort to discover its plan and laws. We believe that we have made much progress in this direction. We have lifted many phases of personal behavior out of the realm of theology and abstract ethics, and into the realm of scientific knowledge. We do not contend that we have learned all of these laws, nor that we ever shall. We do know, however, that many of these things are governed by laws which are just as definite, inflexible, and impersonal, as the laws which govern your physical sciences. We obey them not solely as a matter of ethics, but more because we know that the results of defying them will be very unpleasant for us. If you defy the law of gravity and jump from a high building, your body will be smashed on the street below. If you defy the law of thermodynamics and place your hand on a hot stove, you will be badly burned. It is exactly the same in the matter of these other laws. No invisible policeman sees your sin and brings you to justice. No unseen judge finds you guilty and fixes your punishment. You merely suffer the natural and inevitable result of your own incorrect deed.